And we're recording now. Are you recording?
This is going to be good with my cold.
You think?
I play a little cough and sniff too much in here.
It's good.
This is hard to do a mic check.
Well, it's going. Okay.
Mic check.
Okay.
Check
one, two. You guys got a chance to meet Chris, and he is the area director for Clay County Young Life. Am I right?
Yes.
And so he has done a lot of research. I was talking to, I think, Shelley, and he's going to condense for us a whole book into 45 minutes, which, let me tell you, it'd take you a lot more time to read it. So it's a good book, but it's going to be much better just having somebody tell us all about it. So before Chris begins, and he'll explain the papers and everything to give you, why don't we pray, and we'll get started. God, we give you thanks for tonight. We give you thanks for the gift of children and the young people that we have in our lives. And we thank you for this opportunity where we have a chance to gather together to discern what it means to be good influences and good parents in our young people's lives. Use Chris to speak your truth to us. Open our ears and our hearts and our minds that we might know and understand how best we can minister to our own children and those children that are in our lives. We lift all this in Jesus' name.
Thank you, Becky. All right. Well, hey, welcome. Let me grab your sheet. I just wanted to start just by thanking you guys for showing up, first of all. It may sound like a little thing, but, you know, as somebody who works with kids for a living, it's like a huge blessing and an encouragement to me for anybody to show up for stuff like this. So I just want you guys to know right off the bat that you guys have blessed me just by your presence here. So even if you don't listen to anything I say tonight, you just being here helps me. And that's really what this is all about. So just kidding. So I want to start just by praying for you guys and just praying for blessings for you guys, if that's okay. Jesus, thank you so much that there are adults in this community that still care for kids and still have a heart for kids coming to know Christ. I just pray for this time that my words would be your words, and that the truth that is remembered and written down and carried away from here would be valuable for bringing the kids that we all know closer to you. Pray all these things in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, so I'm going to make a confession right off the bat here. I'm by no means an expert in any of this. I'm taking a seminary course right now. And so basically, I'm regurgitating a lot of information to you guys that I've been absorbing over the last 6 months or so. So my biggest challenge in all this was filtering down all of these things I've been learning and condensing it all into, I feel like, a summary that doesn't do most of it justice, but hopefully it'll just get you guys thinking about a few more things and give you some helpful info, and I'll give you some resources to follow up on that. So, that being said, let's jump into it. So tonight we're talking about understanding adolescence, and part one of that is just defining what an adolescent is. First, the term and its history. The term was coined by a guy named G. Stanley Hall, who wrote a book in 1904 called Adolescence. He was the first one to use that term. He was an evolutionary biologist. And so the term he used to the Latin term that it comes from is adolesceres, which you're not going to want to know any of this later on, but I'm interested in stuff like this, so I'm going to share with you guys. But it's adolesceres is when a species is evolving, according to evolution, from one species to another. So from like a fish to a monkey or something like that. It's an adolesceres is the species in between that connects those two. And so G. Stanley Hall was the first guy to notice, well, something's going on in our culture. Kids aren't quite going from childhood to adulthood. There's some kind of transition. And so he took that term and applied it to that observation he made, and he called it adolescence. So that's where that comes from. Brief history. Next we'll do a brief history, and then we'll define adolescence. All right, very, very brief history is there has not always been adolescence. Big surprise. Roughly pre-industrial revolution. That's really the marker that we're going to use to work with. So really, for all of human history, before the Industrial Revolution, the vast majority of cultures around the world had some sort of rites of passage, some sort of mechanisms in place for clearly defining what it means to transition from childhood to adulthood. The community agreed on it. It was the way it was. Once the kids did those things, they were considered an adult. Around the Industrial Revolution, something happened. And ever since then, it's been a little bit different. What happened was, without going into great detail, society fragmented. Society started moving much more rapidly. The changes in society started happening much more rapidly than ever before. And the cultural identity of the community couldn't really keep up. And so what happened was society started to fragment. These cultural rites of passage that transition kids from childhood to adulthood started to disappear. And this really started in the West, where the Industrial Revolution happened, and spread globally. Today, this is a global phenomenon, not just an American thing. So with the fragmentation of society, Western culture lost its cultural, the technical term is meta-narrative. Meta just really means like grand or overarching, and narrative is like its story, but it's story in like the fullest sense of that term. It's really the overarching story of a people group, of a society. It's really like the cultural story that connects a group of people together. And with the fragmentation of Western culture, we lost that identity. We lost those things to be able to pass down to our kids. Around the late 19th, early 20th century, like G. Stanley Hall, he was a social scientist, took notice of the phenomenon of adolescence. But it wasn't until around the mid-30s that society really began to take notice. Because it makes sense, because right around 1900, between that and the 30s, a lot was going on. You had a world war, you had the roaring 20s, followed by the rock bottom Great Depression. So society was thinking about a lot of stuff. But around the mid-30s, society began to take notice. And you see this in the rise of state-sponsored education. Because around the turn of the 20th century, you really... Only the statistics vary depending on how you interpret the data, but around only 1% of all high school aged kids actually went to high school. The rest of them worked on farms or the family trade or whatever. Around the 30s, it was mandated in every state in the union that all kids in high school had to complete high school. And so you had these little things like that that really showed that society was starting to take notice. You had parachurch ministries start to pop up around the country, like Young Life is one of those. The movement got started in the late 30s, 1941. Young Life, by the way, is who I work for. It's a youth ministry. In 41, Young Life incorporated and became an official thing. In the late 40s, you had Youth for Christ, another major youth ministry pop up. But you had a lot of that stuff starting to take root right around this time. All that to say, with the fragmentation of society, what happened was kids were left to figure out for themselves how to move from childhood to adulthood. They no longer had a community around them. They no longer had a group of adults who agreed upon the standards by which they moved from childhood to adulthood. And so adolescence is really a phenomenon defined by the abandonment of children by society to figure out for themselves how to get from childhood to adulthood. It's the systemic abandonment of children by society to figure that out. And that's really what we're talking about when we're talking about adolescence. Any questions so far?
Is that book definition, your definition? Or?
That definition's taken straight from Chap Clark's book called Hurt, which Becky is holding up right there. Beautiful. We get no royalties whatsoever for that happening. All right. To the middle. Oh, sure.
Thanks.
Absolutely. I'm new to mics and things. This makes me nervous.
Just keep talking into it.
Okay.
Get recorded like that.
All right.
This conversation we're having.
Great. So, tell my mom to check the internet later. She'll be excited.
Okay.
All right. So, let's look now at a little closer. So, that's the definition of adolescence. Let's look at what adolescence is. You can think of adolescence as a journey. It's a quest, really, defined by three parts, three major questions that kids need to ask themselves and to figure out for themselves. Really, these questions can be thought of, the technical terms, it's called the quest for individuation. That's the textbook definition there, the term there. Individuation, defined up there on the screen, being moving from dependence on family to define who we are, to defining for ourselves who we are. And the adolescent journey, the process of moving through adolescence, is the process of figuring out for yourself who you are, separate from family. And there are three I'm just going to give you all the textbook stuff and then kind of go into it a little more. There are three basic quests of individuation. What that means, what the three quests of individuation, it sounds very fanciful, but what that really means is that there's three essential questions every adolescent needs to have settled for themselves before they're ready for adulthood. There's a question of identity. There's a quest to figure out for themselves who they are. Quest for autonomy and quest for belonging. Looking at the first one, quest for identity. This is really the task of asking the question, who am I as distinct from others? And how do I relate? And in that, how do I relate to those around me? So who am I as distinct from others, from my family in particular? And how do I relate to those around me? Another thing going along with this, there is a somewhat popular misconception about what exactly this is and what it isn't. Most people think of this process as identity formation. And what most people would describe this process as being, it's basically like, and this is very observable, a lot of these things are very observable in teenagers, which leads people to think that this is how it is with most kids. But how many, you all have teenagers in here, I'm assuming. Am I right? Okay. So a lot of us will look at teenagers and go, okay, well, Johnny is really into soccer, and that's his life, and that's who he is. Well, then the next day, and he's, you know, basically a nice kid, doesn't get into much trouble. Well, then the next day he comes home, and he wants to be a punk rocker, hates soccer, and, you know, he's a total jerk, and you're wondering what's going on. And the common assumption there is that, well, Johnny has gone to school and observed a personality and a temperament and a lifestyle that he thinks is really cool, and he's just kind of absorbed that and is just kind of going with that. And so identity formation is really like the process of collecting all of these identities, pieces and portions of identities and temperaments and interests and likes and dislikes. And your identity out of that would be like a collection, a summary of that collection of personality types. The problem with this is that this is a very outside-in view of identity formation. We, as Christians especially, intuitively know that the world can't tell us who we are. You know, it's ingrained in us that that's just not how it works. It's not an outside-in process. Theologically, we know, as Christians, that it is God who gives us identity. You know, Psalm 139, I knit you together in your mother's womb. Jesus's emphasis on the individual and his care for the individual, seeking out the woman at the well in John 4, calling Nicodemus out of the tree, knowing these people by name and caring for them as individuals. That is really a wonderful picture in God's heart for us as individuals. So rather than identity formation, a great way to think of this is identity discovery. It's an outside-in process. So Johnny may abandon soccer and abandon being nice for a little while to do all these other things, but what this process is, it's a process of trial and error. Out of that, he's discovering likes and dislikes, truth from lies about himself. And that's really the task at hand there. Is that clear? Any questions about that? I know this is a lot of information. When I first heard all this, it took me like a month to process it all. So I'm trying to give you guys an outline. And then I really want to leave some time at the end. You'll see on part four there, ministering to adolescents. I didn't put a lot there because I want to leave it open for discussion. So that's really where we're headed. So again, so we're all on the same page here. Three basic questions that adolescents struggle with. So there's a quest for identity. Who am I as I relate to others? Next one is quest for autonomy. It's asking the question, do I matter? Am I an agent of change in this world? Can I do anything to change or influence those around me? And we defined autonomy. What we mean by autonomy is personal power. Power being defined as the ability to say that I believe I am an agent of change or influence in this world. And you see a lot, you see this a lot when you observe teenagers. You see the popular kid who knows that he's got a lot of gifts and abilities, and sometimes will use those negatively, to use that power he has negatively to destroy another kid. Sometimes you see it used to build up another kid, but it's all this process of experimenting and figuring out their limits and their abilities and the extent to which they can influence those around them. And the quest for belonging, or do I have a place, or who will take me in? When it really comes down to it, who will be there to care for me? And that's the quest for belonging. Yes.
For autonomy, influencing change, sort of like the way you described it, sort of a testing of power.
Yeah.
That influence, and it strikes me that in the home, in that world, is probably a place where a lot of conflict happens over that test. You know, can I influence my parents? Can I rebel? I mean, it works out as rebellion.
Absolutely.
This,
absolutely.
I mean, it happens with peers, certainly, but
sure.
I think from a lot of standpoints here, that's where we see it a lot.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, this is the dynamic that goes on with everyone around them, every social interaction they have.
Yeah, so, but as parents, when they rebel, it's hard to find a balance where you don't kill their spirit,
right.
But then you still let them be who they are.
Right.
That seems to be the trick of it all.
Exactly.
Recognizing that's a part of it,
but it's like, where's the boundary?
And there's no easy answer for this. I mean, it depends on, it's different for every kid, different for every family. And so I'm not going to give you an easy answer. So this is what you do.
Not fair.
Here's three steps for that.
Well, I think one of the biggest answers is communication.
Absolutely.
You know, if you talk to them and try and figure out, why are you so rebellious about this issue? You know, why is it so important to you? And I'll tell you why it's so important to me. Then you realize, wow, okay, I didn't think of it that way.
That's if you've got one that's willing to talk, willing to listen, willing to
sit. And it could be as subtle as taking their opinion, taking their suggestions, you know. Where do you want to go to dinner tonight? Well, give them some decision-making power. It could be as subtle as that. But, yeah, it may depend on every family. Every family may be different. But to summarize the adolescent journey, really, you have completed the journey of adolescence, the process of adolescence, when you have settled the three questions of adolescence. Who am I as I relate to others? Do I matter? Do I have the power to change or influence those around me? And where do I belong? Once you've settled those questions for yourselves, you've said to have individuated or completed adolescence. I use the word settle deliberately there. You shouldn't think of this as like we're pouring concrete and then it's done and then it's like solidified. Think of it more as jello. You know, it starts off as liquid, you put it in the fridge, it congeals, but it's never really like solid. It's never really quite there. There's some wiggle still. To some extent, we'll always be.
That's
one wrote.
I was
going to
say, I know people who are still working on this.
Exactly.
And they have meltdowns.
Exactly. Absolutely. So to some extent, we're always going to be figuring out who we are, where we belong, what kind of power and influence we can exert over the world around us. And so once it's pretty much settled, once it's not an all-consuming question that they have, they've said they're technically have individuated or completed the process of adolescence. And finally, adolescence is the task of moving from dependency as a child to interdependency as an adult. We're about to get into the stages. But basically, just so we're clear about the big picture, I'm a big picture person, so if I don't have the big picture, I'm useless. But the big picture is that you're moving from childhood, which is completely defined by dependence. Your family defines who you are, has the power over you, and what's the last one there? And that's where you belong. That's your world there. You're moving from that context to a context of interdependent relationships in the adult community. Not independence, but interdependence. You're an adult when the adult community and society accepts you into that society, relies on you, and you rely on other adults. That's how we're going to, just for the sake of this discussion, define adulthood. And so the adolescent journey is moving from the dependence as a child to the interdependence as an adult. Make sense? All right. So, stages of adolescence. There's three. First, easy to remember, is I like when they don't come up with a clever...
They all start
to see. That's kind of thing. I can never remember those. But early, middle, and late, I can remember that. So looking at early adolescence first, this is approximately junior high age. So this is approximately, I put 12 to 14. Some people say 11 to 15. These ages flex a little bit. But there is a very specific, and it changes for each kid, but there's this very specific determining factor for the start of adolescence, and that is puberty. And we'll just kind of leave that at that. But a very important thing to keep in mind is that about early adolescence is that they're concrete thinkers across the board with everything they do and everything they value. If you're nice to them, they're nice to you. If you're mean, they're mean to you. If you're mean to me now but nice to me later, well, that's later, and I'll probably be nice to you then. It is what's in front of them is their reality, is their world, and that's
like tunnel vision.
Absolutely. They're not big into why. Asking the question why. It's just kind of how it is. And it's right in front of me, and that's what's there. So that, in a nutshell, is early adolescence. Middle adolescence, this is where it gets really complicated and interesting. This is roughly high school age. Just because we're all friends here, we'll go with that, because it's a clean definition. But I put 14 to 18 up here. Another popular definition there is 15 to 20. So a lot of people would say it goes into the first couple of years of college. But basically, this is the transition from, developmentally, this is the transition from concrete thinking to abstract thinking. So they're moving from the what's and the how questions to the why questions. And this is problematic developmentally because for the first time in their lives, they are figuring out that there is a whole world out there that has a lot of agendas for them. And they don't yet have the sophistication developmentally to discern whether or not these agendas are good or bad. And so when they hit this age, they reject all agendas coming from the adult world to some extent. The definition from the textbook definition is called egocentric abstraction. Egocentric meaning self-centered. It's still about them. Abstraction, though, meaning they have the capability for abstract thought. They are able to think deeply about systems and about the way things work, but it all relates back to them. And it's also defined, middle adolescence is also defined by the inability to connect contexts. And this is where it gets tricky and kind of interesting. What I mean by that is a kid will interact, let's say a kid from youth group, will interact in that context of youth group in a way that will just knock your socks off. I mean, you're going to put them on the billboard for your youth group. They are the poster child. They get it, and they are able to interact in that world with ease. Well, that kid will also have a Saturday night context, which could totally contradict the values that they firmly believe in youth group context. But the reason that they can exist in all these different worlds, and there are multiple contexts that they exist in, is, they lack the ability to connect bridges between these. So they lack the ability to say, well, the values and morals and expectations for me in the youth group world, I don't see how those apply to Saturday night world or to soccer practice world. And so some kids will develop almost completely different personality traits and temperaments depending on those contexts. One guy doing the study, a study in the late 90s on adolescents, just sat in a high school for like 6 months and would just sit in the teacher's lounge, and he spent a lot of time going from class to class. He would follow specific classes and take notes. And he noticed kids going from science class to gym class would be a totally different kid. And so he would, just to have some fun, he said he would sit in the teacher's lounge, and when two of the teachers of the same kid would be in there, he would say, just to get the ball rolling, you know, Susie is just a really quiet kid. You know, we need to figure out a way to get her to talk more. And a science teacher for Susie would say, oh, I know. We really need to get her to open up. Well, gym teacher for Susie will go, are you kidding me? She is the worst kid I have. She is constantly making out under the bleachers and running around, not bringing her clothes to dress out in and stuff like that. And so, but they lack the ability to connect these contexts. They develop their personality. They develop who they are in those contexts to fulfill their needs. So they become who they need to be to fulfill the need for positive reinforcement and adult relationships. And they will become who they need to be to get that out of those contexts. Kind of complicated, kind of heady. I hope you're tracking with me, though, because it's great stuff to know. It's great stuff to know. And late adolescence. This is roughly college and young professionals. Again, it's a sort of a sliding scale, but roughly 18 to mid-20s in females, and some would say mid to late 40s in males. Exactly. So, thank you for laughing. Appreciate that. And what's funny...
It's a different class.
It's a totally different ballgame. What's funny about this, though, and this is sort of the irony of this whole seminar, or whatever you want to call it, is I'm 25 years old, so I'm still well within the definition of most people's view of adolescence. So it's a little bit awkward, but we're all friends here. So.
Speaking from experience.
Yeah, exactly. But in the stage of late adolescence, the person is wrapping up and settling for themselves the three questions, the three quests of individuation. And it ends not when they complete that quest, but when society, when the adult society and community accepts them into the adult world. Because a 17-year-old can settle for themselves the questions that they ask, the three questions, but it's not until society views them as an adult and is ready to enter into interdependent relationships with them that they're really out of adolescence. So Doogie Howser, you know, he could have been really smart and a doctor, but he hadn't hit puberty yet, so he's got a long way to go. So are there any questions about this? All right, beautiful.
That's like 18, you can vote, but you can't yet drink. 21, you can drink, but you can't yet run a car.
Mm-hmm. You can fight, but you can't drink, too.
Exactly. You can fight in the army, but you can't drink or rent a car.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's part of that fragmentation, you know? Depending on who you talk to, some people will say that an adolescent is a little adult. Some people will say that an adolescent is a big kid, And they'll have very, very adamant opinions about that. Mm-hmm. To say otherwise, you'll just cause a fight. But it is confusing when you say, well, you can drive at 16, you can drink, or you can drink at 21, smoke at 18, fight in Iraq at 18, but we're still not going to really accept you as an adult. Well, maybe like late 20s, maybe have a kid or two and we'll talk. It's really confusing. And it feeds into this sense of abandonment. It's what we're talking about when we say that it is a societal abandonment. The best parents in the world, their kids are going to go through adolescence, because parents, it's not just about that. It's about the culture as a whole. And so as much as it stinks, you know, kids are going to have to go through this. And by definition, they have to go through it alone. It's a process that we can only walk beside them. We can't walk with them or carry them through it. They have to do it on their own. We can be there for them as much as possible, but it's the term a lot of people use is the tightrope of adolescence. And it's a pretty accurate term. So those are the three stages. So to conclude this and open up some discussion, I want to offer two thoughts on how to, keeping all this in mind, how to effectively minister to this age group, bring the gospel into this age group. First, I think we need to view ministry to adolescents as the responsibility of the entire church, big C. I don't think that it's fair to, knowing all this about youth development and adolescent culture, it can't be up to the youth minister or the Young Life leader, Youth for Christ leader, whoever. That it can't be up to that one person to do this job. We as the church need to accept responsibility for this. We need to be in the business of creating this meta-narrative that society isn't able to provide for them anymore. Why is it the responsibility of the church? Because it all goes back to the Great Commission. Jesus says, go and make disciples of all the nations. Well, part of that command to us and reaching all people with the gospel is also overcoming all the obstacles between you and bringing the gospel to those people. And so when you're ministering in a culture where hunger is an obstacle between you and your ability to effectively share God's word with them, well, you need to figure out a way to get food to these people. And that's part of ministering and fulfilling the Great Commission to those people. Prison ministry, you know, a lot of broken relationships. Counseling will be an important component of that ministry. But when you're dealing with adolescents, you need to create, we need, as a community, create a meta-narrative that these kids can find their identity in. And it needs to be a community effort to walk beside these kids through these years. It's just a food for thought. Second, it must be relational. In my experience with teenagers, they are unbelievable. They have a very high sense of BS. I mean, they can sniff it from a mile away. If you are not genuine in your attempt to care for a kid, if they sense that you have some type of agenda, they will reject you outright. We need to be about caring for them. It's sort of naive to say we're not going to have an agenda. I think the best relational ministry to kids has the agenda of them growing in their relationship with Christ, growing into a deeper relationship with Christ. But I would argue that that's where it should end. With me in Young Life, it's a little bit of a tightrope sometimes dealing with this, because our primary job is to build relationships with kids and hang out with them on their own turf. But we also have events like club and campaigners and camp and different things like that that I really want kids to come to. And so there's this fine line of caring for them where they're at and loving them as they are and wanting them to come to my stuff. Because it does happen sometimes to where a kid will say, well, he's probably just hanging out with me to get me to come to club. it's terrible. I don't want to give them that impression. It's not how it is. But if they sense that at all, they'll reject it. So it's got to be relational, but relational meaning our only agenda is them growing in their relationship with Christ, and it's got to be genuine care for them and who they are. And it can't be an event like a seminar where we gather all the youth and say, hey, we just wanted to let you guys know we really care about y'all. And now, you know, be well, go in peace, to love, and serve the Lord. Now, it's got to be a lifetime commitment of walking with them in life. So those are my thoughts. That's my presentation. I really wanted to leave some time. We got about 15 minutes here. You know, there's a lot more wisdom in here in dealing with adolescents than my 25-year-old experience has. So I want to learn from you guys. So what are you guys' thoughts on this? And yeah.
Mm-hmm. You get out your photo albums, and I've done this with my kids, and that doesn't mean I'm successful, but
yeah.
You get out the photo albums and look at pictures when they were a baby and go through and remember so many things that you did when you used to love each other. Most kids love to see pictures of themselves when they were a baby and how cute they were, and even siblings, you know, sometimes they'll be like, oh, I remember when you were born, oh, it was so exciting. Mm-hmm. And then you do things that they want to do. I mean, most teenagers don't want to do anything with their parents, but sometimes, I mean, like, I've just found my daughter loves to go shopping. Yeah, it's expensive, and it's all about her, but
yeah.
It's something that she and I can do, and then you have to agree on what you're buying. There's a whole other issue.
Right.
But I think, really, we're just all in such a mad rush all the time. Mm-hmm. And I think exactly what you were saying with the church, and I think with parents, too. I mean, and I'm here because I need help in these areas myself. But I think exactly what you were saying is really true. They do. They can tell if you are not sincere. Mm-hmm. Or I know sometimes I'll be doing something and my daughter will say something, and I'm in the middle of something, and she'll say, Mom, you weren't even listening.
Yeah.
And that is really, they know.
Absolutely. But that's great what you're saying. Pulling out the photo albums, giving them a sense of a context, giving them a sense of belonging. And letting them make decisions, that autonomy we were talking about, giving them power over even little things. It makes a difference. That's great.
Well, I think further in the book, you know, you were defining adolescence as this societal abandonment, but it's not just a society abandoning teenagers, because it happens on a smaller level, too. Mm. I mean, mm-hmm. Parents get busy, families get busy. Schedules just fill up, and whether we mean to or not, there's a sense of abandonment even within the family or even within the church. You know, let's
right.
shove the kids over here, or and you know, churches I think are trying to move away from that kind of mentality, and I think our church is doing a good job of that. But still, it happens, and there's kind of this sense of, well, we don't want, which is why he chose to title his book Hurt, because he says that's what kids are feeling from all sorts of places, is, and then even their friends are abandoning them too, like we were talking about earlier.
So yeah.
It happens in a lot of
Yeah, and that's, especially in middle adolescence, that's what makes it so incredibly difficult, is because they're sorting all this out, surrounded by a bunch of people sorting all this out. And so it's like, you know, sharks with meat, you know, I mean, they rip each other apart sometimes. So yeah. They need, the rule of thumb that he gives, since we're on Chap Clark, is to, when we're talking about meta-narrative, establishing that meta-narrative, he says a good rule of thumb is 5 caring adults actively invested in each kid. That is the minimum framework that we should strive for when we're talking about establishing that meta-narrative. And that's, it doesn't have to be like, you know, we each say, oh, I'll take Ethan, and you have to go like bowling with him every Friday or something. I mean, it's remembering like his birthday and maybe send him a card and calling him every now and then and say, how'd that test go? You know, just little things where they know that you are actively engaged and what's going on with them, and you care for them where they're at.
Strikes me that from a parent's standpoint, this idea of relating to them without having an agenda, often parents, the agenda is, I just want you to behave.
Yeah.
I just want you to be a good boy or a good girl. I just want you to obey me. I'm the adult, you're not. And whereas that's, I mean, there's a degree to which, you know, that is reasonable, it can fall into an agenda that's ahead of the relationship.
Yeah.
And what we do often in the church, or in Christian circles, and not just in the church, but in Christian circles, is we lift up the idea of obedience ahead of relationship without really meaning to.
Yeah.
We've had curriculums and, you know, how to raise children that obey, and it's a formulaic way of raising kids. And it strikes me that that can be such an underneath hidden agenda.
Yeah.
That can undermine the intent of it.
Well, that's what Absolutely. We're talking about in our Parenting is Heart Work class, too, that we're doing right now. And that's, we've been talking about younger kids, but it's actually designed for up to age 18. And we're talking about right now about all the things that kids are tracking in their heads. And yeah. I think that that is what's going on. And I think sometimes when they do feel like it's an agenda or you're trying to manipulate them, then you sort of reinforce those ideas of, you know, they don't really care about me, I'm just here to take out the trash or whatever, and yeah. all these little crazy thoughts that they get in their heads. And what we're learning in this class is that behavior or obedience is a symptom of the heart. And
yeah.
so it's not, even if you control the behavior or the symptom, you're still not reaching the heart attitude of the child. And I think that this really kind of reinforces that idea, especially when you talk about the journey that they're going on. I mean, they're trying to discover, you know, what their real heart attitude is.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it's, you know, as I have a one-year-old, so I'm not quite where you guys are at yet.
But starts then. I mean, I have a 10-year-old. I'm a teenager, so that's my disclaimer. But really, I mean, I'm reading this stuff and I'm thinking about it. I mean, it starts
yeah.
then. They don't just suddenly, you know, when they turn 11, turn it on. It's,
right.
it's building up to that.
Oh, he's in the tantrum phase. I'm fully aware of.
He's egocentric, isn't he?
Oh, my gosh. He's so self-centered. You need to talk to him about that. But yeah, I mean, as parents, there are expectations we have of our kids. Even in our relationship with Christ, there are more commandments that Christ, he says, my yoke is easy, my burden is light. But there are things that he commands us to do in our relationship with him. So there are more expectations than the general feel good, you know, just grow closer to me. But I think it's important to keep in mind just the grace component in all this, you know. We talked about Jesus earlier. He was a guy whose leadership style and whose, you know, as king of the universe, his modus operandi, is that what it is, was grace. And so kids are going to fall short all the time. I fall short all the time. But it's just important that they know that your acceptance of them, my acceptance of them, has nothing to do with their ability to perform. Yeah.
Yeah. Married, well, 19, oh. excuse me, 19 and married, and, you know, so you're expecting he should be an adult and acting this way.
Right. Not quite there.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
And so most of the time it is getting after him for not doing this, not doing that. You're, you know, not living it or not doing what you should be doing, not
yeah.
getting the job. Are you doing good in school? And that relation part sometimes just... It's real hard to...
Yeah. But part of that is, depending on the approach, and you seem like a very nice lady, and so I'm sure your approach is very sweet. But... we'll not get into that. We'll not get into that.
That's a different class. Yeah.
I don't think they heard that on the tape, so that's great. But kids actually like to know that people are looking out for them, giving them a hard time a little bit. It's not a total negative thing.
I just think part of what makes us so tricky even more today, I think even more today than when I was an adolescent, is that in the school, in the family, in every sector of society, kids are given greater and greater responsibility, and they're treated on one level more adult-like, yet they're not.
Yeah.
So there's this real confusion about role identity, and you know, they have the weight of responsibility. I mean, parent today telling me about a St. John's kid who can't get into college, and the weight of, you know, I did the right thing, I went to the right school, and
yeah,
and just kids, the burden that they're carrying,
sure,
is immense in that sense.
Yeah, I think
they're
that's
still
why
they're still fragile,
yeah,
and developing.
Mm-hmm. It's that double bind that, you know, that I think they really are. And I think that's why I was thinking as we were going through this, why that relationship with Jesus is so important. I mean, that they have that foundation, that solid thing that they can keep falling back on, you know, and not be defined by all of these. I'm not defined by what college I go to, you know. I'm defined,
yeah,
as a child of Christ, and how important it is that we make sure that, you know, is a constant for them. They know they can always go back to.
And that's what's encouraging about all this for us, is when we look at the, you know, the questions and the quest for individuation. I mean, we have answers to those questions. I mean, what is their identity? You are God's child. You are created in Christ to serve, to love and serve Him. You know, where is your power? You have the power to advance the kingdom of God in this world. You know. Where do you belong? You belong in the church. You belong to God. And we have truth to bring to them. It's just we need to do it together, and we need to figure out a way to be relevant in sharing these truths with them. Yeah. Well, any more thoughts? Any more questions?
Something that is going on with us at home is that they say they don't want you there, but they really do. And so,
yeah,
finding that balance between when do you show up and when do you not, and it seems like when you don't, then they're mad that you don't. When you do, they're mad that you, you know, it's just like, you know, trying to figure out how and where to plug in so that you're not, you know, stifling them, and yet you,
yeah,
want to show interest. So
it's like, what are,
yeah,
we really saying?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Err on the side of too much.
Yeah.
You know? I mean,
yeah,
that's what I would think. You know, ignore the, you know, oh, Mom, I can't believe you're embarrassing me. Just be there too much.
I think even if they don't appreciate it now,
yeah,
later on they'll look back and go, you know, my mom always showed up.
Yeah.
In a world where most parents don't, my mom showed up.
Yeah,
that is going to mean a lot.
Expecting,
yeah.
Or that may be what their friends' parents aren't showing up. And, oh, I don't want to be embarrassed, but deep down, they're probably saying, but I'm going to be hurt if they're not there.
Mm-hmm. And there's so much
deep
about
down,
saying,
I want that,
like,
yeah,
what they think they should be saying, like,
yeah,
they're watching, okay,
right,
other kids,
right,
are okay,
right,
without mom and dad, so I should be okay with that, but maybe in their heart, they really aren't, and so that's
but
why
I,
you're getting those mixed
I
messages.
Have known kids who are like, my mom was on me all the time, she was never, you know, so... There is a balance.
There's a balance.
Yeah.
I think, you know, yeah, I mean, maybe you don't show up to their soccer game and, like, run down right next to them, like, in their face,
right,
but you can be,
yeah,
in the crowds and you can,
yeah,
be there.
But
that's
maybe
they
can see, at least,
mm-hmm,
yeah,
at a distance, see,
mm-hmm,
that you're there. That I've kind of found
don't
that, too.
Don't talk to
my daughter.
Yeah.
Man,
yeah, that's what we do.
I like that part.
Yeah, we see a lot of the, I didn't understand the philosophy behind it until I read the part of the book. But, you know, we see kids in a different context, and I'm sure you do too, you know.
Yeah.
But parents will say to me, well, they're just a nightmare at home, and they backtalk me all the time, and blah, 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 but that's not the kid that we see. We
yeah.
see this really polite, nice kid that runs up and hugs you and just wants to be with you.
Yeah.
And it's hard to imagine that there's another side of it.
Yeah. And there could be a lot factored into that. Maybe they're not experiencing, maybe they're seeking some power at home.
Yeah, well, it makes sense,
there's,
though, that in every group they might be somebody different.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think Alex is definitely multifaceted. I mean, at school, he's this terror. At home, he's this terror, but bring him to church, and
he's
the
an
best
angel.
Kid in the world.
Mm.
You know, and it's like they adapt to whatever environment they're in at the time. You know, and it's like, because I had people come, oh, your daughter's the most wonderful girl in the world. I'm like, my daughter? Yeah. You know.
ago, I had somebody, I'd say, are you talking about our children?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I had an older parent say, you know, you've done your job right. If you can't deal with them, you can't stand them, but if they're good for other people and out in society, they're doing the right things, mm-hmm. then you've done your job.
Yeah.
I always have to try and remember that when they're at home and you can't deal with them, but outside, everybody else sees them as being a, you know, they're
my Alex won't yes ma'am and no ma'am me, but yeah. he gets out and about around other adults and he will. And so it's like, you know, how much fight do you put up?
So he has
done something right.
Well, at my house, I always say, I don't want justice. I just want peace. But
that's funny.
In Kimberly's class, we're talking a lot about, you know, getting to the heart of things and it is so important to realize that even though they're fighting you on things, there's sometimes a big, you know, a big issue that's on their hearts, and that's the reason they're, you know, doing what they're doing or reacting the way they're acting. So,
and they might not even be able to articulate that.
That's true.
Yeah. We can sit here and say, well, clearly you're trying to form your identity, and you're asking, who am I? Like, but they're not.
I
took this class. I mean, they're not going to be able to articulate that for themselves, but I think, like we were saying, later on, you know, they're going to appreciate the fact that mom was there, or, you know, I was thinking, I saw this video years ago, and I don't even know if you can get it anymore, but I think Kimberly and I were talking about it on PBS. They did a 2-hour thing called The Lost Children of Rockdale County. And it was this documentary about these kids whose parents were, you know, working until, what, you know, 7 o'clock at night, and the kids weren't involved in sports or anything, so they come home from school and were bored out of their minds. So they started a sex club and started spreading syphilis around. That's how it got discovered. All these kids were going in for syphilis. Well, part of it, and then it, you know, expanded into more when they go to spring break and blah, blah, blah. But I remember one kid who was like, I mean, he was a little bit older, he was like 18 or 19 in the video, and he said, my parents never gave me any rules. Like, I don't have any rules. And he goes, I wish my parents had given me rules. I so wish they had set some boundaries for me, because I didn't know how to do that for myself. And now I've had all these experiences I wish I've never had. And it's that kind of, they're not able to articulate that they want a rule or that they need the rule. And not that you have to give them every rule, but they need the boundaries. They want mom and dad to show up and tell them that they love them and care about them, even if they can't say it yet. So
I think part of that, too, is as a parent, some parents choose to be their kid's friend instead of their kid's parent. And I think that's doing an injustice.
No, I tried
that
being their friend. And that didn't work.
Yeah.
So.
Because then when I tried to discipline her, she's like, but mom.
Well, have you ever been in public and your child or your teenager just acts very badly and it's embarrassing and you want respect and you want gratitude and then you don't handle it right either? and you're acting like in a way that it's like you're stooping to their level. It's really easy to get entangled because you're embarrassed because people see that you don't have that and that's something I try to just avoid, you know, I just don't say anything. It's like, okay, we're going to talk when we get in the car or whatever. You know, I stay really calm, but I have a couple of times I haven't handled it correctly. And I thought, ooh, I was just where she was, you know, because they do, they just are thinking about themselves. That's the thing. That's the truth.
Or they know the buttons to push.
They definitely know buttons.
They like to push those buttons.
Yes, they do.
Well, it is 8:05 and,
Well, and my table's been looking at these. If you want to look at this book, we read it with our leaders last summer. It's good. It's kind of dry. Chris and I
It's pretty heady.
It's pretty heady.
Yeah.
So if you want to read it, you can. Another one that I bought, and I have not read this one. This one's called Disconnected, Parenting Teens in a MySpace World by Chuck Clark and Dee Clark, which I'm going to guess is his wife. I have not read this one, so I don't know if it's good or bad or how is it, but these are a couple of books that, you know, might be helpful.
Chap Clark, just so y'all know who he is, he was on Young Life staff for like 15 years. He is he's a professor at Fuller Seminary, and he realized that there was a need for somebody to have a foot in both the academic world of psychosocial teenager studies and the practical theology world. And so he takes all the studies, he reads all the information, but he tries to relate it to how do we reach kids in this for Jesus. And
I went to his workshop at Orange last year, and he's a pretty intense guy.
Yes.
Yeah.
He is.
I mean, I walked out of there like, whoa, I mean, it just fills you up with stuff.
Absolutely.
Great, somebody told me a book, Approaching Adolescence by Dobson or something. Mm-hmm. Has anybody heard of that one?
I've not.
Is it James Dobson?
Mm-hmm. James Dobson.
Approaching or...
Focus on the food.